news this evening is speculation concerning the real facts behind the Department of Health announcement about a radioactive spill supposed to have occurred yesterday at the state nuclear plant.
I know what you're thinking. Mine's bigger than yours, right? It's not fair. Throw it away. All right? All right!
Tell me about Disneyland.
They got tons of popcorn there.
Yeah.
And all you gotta do is go climb a tree to go eat it.
It was a night like any other night. Then something happened.
Oh, good Lord. It's unbelievable. It's horrible.
Hey, wait, there's something weird here.
Welcome to the Really Awful Movies Podcast, a celebration of low-budget cinema.
The sleep of reason gives birth to monsters.
Hi, my name's Chris, and along with Jeff, we're bringing you the very best and worst of horror, sci-fi, post-apocalyptic wasteland, kung fu, women in prison movies from the 1960s to today. Check us out at reallyawfulmovies.com, part of the Crypt TV family.
You can't say no. Every lock of food. With every beat, your heart will answer yes. Where lovers sing instead of talk, and dance instead of walk together. In a night that's filled with stars, and strumming guitars, you can't say no. In Acapulco, where romance blooms and love is in the air. So kiss me tender, love me true, darling, feel this magic too. Don't say no, you can't say no.
We're downtown Toronto headquarters. Here's episode 175. Thank you very much. Fun in Acapulco. Elvis, an Elvis vehicle from the early 60s, 1963 to be precise. How much fun is fun in Acapulco?
Well, wow, that's a loaded question. Because, in the history of rock and roll, there are many stories of tragedy. Many, many, many stories. Many people that died young, many people that died before their time.
Oh, the infamous age 27, Janis Joplin,
Jim Morrison, Jimi Hendrix, Kurt Cobain, Amy Winehouse, all people died at age 27. But I mean, there's lots of tragedies. I mean, there's plane crashes that have taken people's lives.
Leonard Skinner,
I honestly don't think there's a more tragic figure in the annals of rock and roll than Elvis Aaron Presley. This is a man that burst onto the scene in the mid-50s, and talk about a revolution. He basically almost invented youth culture. When he came out there, swiveling his hips and gyrating and singing about, you know, the Heartbreak Hotel and Mystery Train and all shook up and blue suede shoes. And the kids were losing their minds and the adults were losing their minds for a very different reason, because they thought that he was the devil incarnate. And this is long before he got, you're the devil in disguise. They thought he created the Fuhrer and Elvis mania. It was incredible. But it was almost like this period of Elvis being like, this force, this cultural force, this youth icon, this symbol for everything that the adults were afraid about.
Yeah, licentiousness and just sexuality and bringing together, I guess, black music with white culture and just transcending any cultural boundary and turning over. I mean, look at what was there at the time. Like your Perry Como and your, these crooners and this very sort of old-fashioned music, and then the turning point with rock and roll, just totally obliterating
that. And, of course, Elvis was coined the king of rock and roll. And, I mean, but this period was a really short period. I mean, it really only lasted from, I would say, 1956 to 1958. Because in 1956 was when he had his first number one hit. That, "This Is My Baby Left Me."
Yeah.
Heartbreak Hotel.
Yeah.
And, of course, you know, it was an infamous appearance in the Ed Sullivan Show where everybody was glued to their TV and... Despite the fact that they would only shoot him from the waist up because his hip gyrations were too blasphemous or ungodly, what have you, he was conscripted to join the army. And that was in the peak of his career. He'd already made a couple movies, but they were actually good movies.
Yeah.
And he was in the army from 1958 to 1960. And when he came out of the army, he was a changed man, or his career was changed, and everything pretty much gone to shit. And as the 60s progressed, Elvis became, of course, you had more youth cultural revolutions with the hippie movement, the mod movement, and so on, in England and whatnot. And Elvis just seemed more and more out of touch. And he tried to come back in the late 60s with the 68 comeback special, which was really great. But that sort of return to the old gut bucket Elvis of old, you know, like dressed in leather and... Once again, like the raw sexuality of Elvis, it gave way to the 70s where we had Vegas Elvis, Fat Elvis. I like Vegas Elvis. I like Fat Elvis because there's something very... The pathos is just tremendous. But the other thing, too, about Elvis in the 70s is some of the songs were cheesy. Some of the songs were damn good, like In the Ghetto. Amazing.
Yeah.
But because the voice was always there. But the whole... gravita, the whole danger, the whole raw umbrella sexuality, the whole embodiment of rock and roll when it came to Elvis Presley died the day that he joined the army. And a lot of it was not Elvis's fault, but the fault of Colonel Tom Parker.
Yeah, who's got a surrogate in this movie, which we'll talk about. Mm-hmm. But it's funny when you talk about Las Vegas, like, Viva Las Vegas. Like, Vegas is just, I mean, Vegas has had its own kind of demise, or I mean, maybe death and rebirth. Like you still associate it with these names of yore, but you also associate it with a different era and nothing that's au courant, nothing that's cool. Like if you're playing in Vegas, unless you're a magician, it has been time and it has been city. And when we were discussing this movie before the podcast, you were talking about Acapulco, and it's funny the Vegas connection because.
Yeah,
so has-beens used to hang out here. Not has-beens. Well, I mean, the Vegas set, the Vegas crew, your Sinatras, those guys would go to Acapulco. Yeah. We asked one another, like, do people go? Like, yeah, it's a 70s thing. It's like a Waldorf salad.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
Where do you find that? It's like, where do you...
I remember in the 80s, my mother went to Acapulco and came back with a gigantic sombrero with the word Acapulco written on it. And I actually wore that sombrero a little bit as a kid. But, I mean, that's the thing. Somebody goes, I'm going to Acapulco. They go to, like, Cancun or...
Yeah, or Cabo or whatever. Any of these places. Mm-hmm. It's just Riviera, so... It's so dated. And I was going to ask you, too, like, I have a very, very ambivalent attitude toward Elvis.
Elvis was a hero to most. We never shit.
Yeah, like Chuck D, put it in perspective.
No,
like,
I like Elvis a lot.
I'm of two minds because, like, my mom was a big fan and I grew up listening to, like, Heartbreak Hotel and all these great songs. But on the other hand, I thought that some of his contemporaries got to a little bit of short shrift during the time, and I thought maybe, I want to say probably because he's such an unlikable, just prickly character that he maybe didn't get the due that he should have. Would have been Ike Turner or one of these characters who was a contemporary where it was like I felt that was more ballsy at the time.
Well, okay,
Okay,
we can talk about Ike. We can talk about Chuck Berry. We can talk about these Little Richard. The reality is, I mean, we were knocking into the whole racial politics, and that's.
Oh no, but I just mean like, the music. I wasn't talking about race. It just the Ike Turner just more affected me a little more.
But what I'm saying
and
is
also
that's why
Little Richard too.
Elvis was the one that was on Ed Sullivan and receiving all these, accolades and whatnot, and not, let's say, Ike Turner and, or what have you.
Yeah, Chuck Berry,
because of the racial politics, and that's why, like, you know, when Chuck D said, you know, Elvis was a hero to most, but he never meant shit to me, it's because they said he co-opted black music.
Yeah, but I don't feel the same about, let's say, Eminem, because I just, maybe it's a sense of, like, misguided purity that you always have associated with songwriters, and given Ike Turner and Elvis, Chuck Berry were such songwriters.
Didn't write
and,
his own songs.
And in the case here of this movie, Bossa Nova.
But then again, neither did Frank Sinatra.
Oh, no. This is true. But in the case of this movie, like the Lieber and Stoller hit Bossa Nova Baby, which is just a great song, but all of the songs were written by someone else, and I've learned to.
And all the songs are fucking terrible in this movie. Yeah.
True, but I've learned to reappreciate someone who interprets songs, whether it's Tony Bennett or Frank Sinatra. But at the time, I was like, "Oh, what's the deal with this guy? He didn't write his own music." So I was dumping on him in a way. I didn't appreciate him, and yet by the same token, I've been to Graceland and I visited the Jungle Room. I've seen his gi that says TCB on the arm. It's like taking care of business. He had like a lightning bolt.
Yeah, of course,
with his like just and that sullied the image as well further, because I have this image of like the guy with a leather jacket making this cool music, and then he becomes like a bloated shut-in in this cheesy mansion with just lack of tact and taste, and
met Richard Nixon and became part of the honorary task force on drugs.
And shooting out his TV for Robert Goulet.
The whole thing, right? Because Elvis was a tragic figure, because, and you know, we talk about mommy issues in horror films and so on. Elvis had mommy issues. When he lost his beloved mother, he was just absolutely devastated.
Yep.
And he fell under the Machiavellian influence of Colonel Tom Parker, who ruled over Elvis with an iron fist, and he was the one that steered him into these lame movies. So the thing is this, and this is Don Siegel, okay, the director of
Invasion of the Body Snatchers.
He directed Elvis in one of his early films, and the early Elvis movies, the first four, Love Me Tender, Loving You, Jailhouse Rock, King Creole, they were fairly decent, respectable movies. Elvis was kind of like, you know, almost like a James Dean type figure, but he did sing in these movies. That was one thing Elvis didn't want to do in his movies. He didn't want to sing. He wanted to be a dramatic actor. But, unfortunately, he made two movies. One was called Flaming Star, the other one was called Wild in the Country, both of which he didn't sing. They were both box office flops. So Parker said, enough of that. You're singing in every movie. And his characters in every movie, they're interchangeable. It doesn't matter if he's in Acapulco, if he's in Hawaii. He did three movies in Hawaii. It doesn't matter if he's a race car driver. It doesn't matter if he's a lifeguard or whatever he was in this movie.
Or part of a flying trapeze act.
He's the same character. So this is a quote from Don Siegel. He goes, Elvis was kind of a joke in the industry as an actor, and he blamed it on the Machiavellian influence of Colonel Tom Parker, who insisted that he would just take... See, the man made 29 movies within the period of 1956 and 1969. They were turning them out one after another. It was pure product, and there were just these
hackneyed pieces of garbage. Like, we were going to talk about Double Trouble. Like, we were banding about different films to see. And when you run through the laundry list, apart from the aforementioned four you mentioned, I mean, there's just a lot of just utter tripe.
They're just these frothy comedic romps or like little travelogues with lame songs, no real sense of danger, no drama, no gravitas, no relevancy. Mm. Elvis himself is neutered, because he now is on screen singing like a fucking neutered Perry Como. There's very little hip gyrations or hip shaking. There's a little bit in this movie, but it's so clumsy and awkward. And yeah, I mean, Elvis on screen was, with the exception of his first four movies, were terrible. And Elvis knew they were terrible. He hated some of those movies. He cites his favorite movie that he was in as King Creole, and his least favorite being Clambake. And oh my God. The thing that's funny about Elvis.
Just thinking, just hearing the titles.
Well, I mean, the thing of the song, like, I mean, Eddie Murphy has this great routine, right, on Delirious, Eddie Murphy Delirious, where he talks about Elvis movies and saying how all Elvis movies are is just Elvis singing whatever the heck is going on. So
in his mind, yeah.
It's like, not in his mind, but actually singing.
Yeah.
So it's like, Elvis, we got to win this race. We got to win this race. Elvis, would you like some lemonade?
Lemonade.
That cool, refreshing drink. Yeah. So Clambake, he actually got his song, Clambake. I'm going to take that clam, I'm going to bake it all up. Like, it's just awful.
So terrible.
Shit, you know what I mean? Oh. And this movie is the same. I mean, We could have done Double Trouble. We could have done Viva Las Vegas. We could have done Blue Hawaii. We could have done all these movies. But we did Fun in Acapulco. But it might as well be any Elvis movie that he made after leaving the army, because they're all just pure shit.
Yeah, and here again, he's working on a boat. in the titular Mexican town, and he gets fired.
Yeah.
And
it's funny too, because this is stuff I found very interesting, because we were talking about Double Trouble, right?
Yeah.
And I started watching a bit of Double Trouble, and in both movies, because here he plays a character by the name of Mike Wingren,
which is a joy to hear with a Latino accent, and then Mike Wingren. It's hard to say, is like in an English Mike Wingren.
Yeah. And he's a man with a past, and he's in Acapulco to try and escape this past. He's an expat and whatnot. And in both this movie and in Double Trouble, he has trouble with a young girl, with an underage girl. And, you know, he keeps on pushing off the amorous advances of a girl who is too young. In this one, the daughter of the person that owned the boat.
Owned the boat, yeah, young Janie, young blonde, yeah.
Yeah, was coming on to him, and he said something along the lines of, I have neckties longer than you.
Yeah, exactly.
Line like that. But that's so ironic, because in real life, Elvis's wife, Priscilla, he met her when she was 14 years
exactly,
old.
Exactly, yeah.
And they had
Jerry Lee Lewis.
Yeah, they had an 8-year courtship, and he was 10 years older when they met. So she was 14, he was 24, they married when she was 21.
So what you're saying is this was just a cynical allusion to that, insofar as he was rebuffing the advances of someone too young, and try and legitimize him as someone who wouldn't do that? Or like what was the motivation
that? I'm saying it's irony, because
I see.
The character is playing on screen.
Okay, I see, yeah.
You know, the virtue, I'm not going to get with you because you're too young.
Okay.
It's not that Elvis in real life who
had
no problems.
Forethought to try and reboot his image somehow.
He didn't tell Priscilla Beaulieu, I believe that was her maiden name, that he had neckties older than her when he met her in Germany when she was all but 14 years old. So, yes, he's on a boat.
Yeah, he gets shit-canned. He finds himself with no opportunity to make ends meet, and who should he come upon? But, again, a young version of a Colonel Tom Parker, albeit, maybe as money-grubbing and as self-interested as he might have been. This comes in the form of the comedic relief as a young boy who's seemingly acquainted with, familial-wise, with everyone in this town.
In Mexico,
he's got a cousin, an uncle who works everywhere. This kid is connected.
Yeah.
And his name is Raul Almeida.
Raul, or as Elvis sometimes pronounce him, Raul.
Yeah. Well, the pronunciation in this movie is beyond the pale. There's a character, Moreno, who he insists on. This isn't Moreno. It's not hard. Moreno. Like, it's raining. More rain. Moreno. He consistently calls the guy Moreno. So, again, it's a sign of the times, maybe, to cite a better film with Prince. this kid becomes his manager and starts to book this phenomenon at all these clubs in Acapulco. And the hilarious thing is all these club owners are willing to take a chance on him. What's the equivalent of sight unseen? Hear unheard. Like, they've never heard his band. And they're willing. He just says, I got this singing sensation, this cantador, I forget what that, it's this singer from North America, and he's going to take the world by storm. And the one guy has a club, and the El Trovador, or Trovador, is the singer and the big performer there. And they get him in on off nights in exchange for having him work the pool.
Well, no, that's the whole thing. He's hired as sort of like a relief singer if El Trovador or whatever is sick. But Elvis actually wants to be a lifeguard. That's what he wants to do. He doesn't want Mike, Elvis, what have you. He meets Moreno, and Moreno is a lifeguard by day, cliff diver by night, champion cliff diver of Acapulco. And he says, you know, when do you ever siesta? Moreno, no. There's a lot of people talking in the third person's movie.
Yeah.
Moreno needs no siesta, he goes. And then, behind his back, Elvis kind of worms his way in and says, I would like to be a lifeguard while Moreno is taking a siesta. And then
that's how he's paid. He's given room and board in exchange for being a lifeguard. Mm-hmm. And then on the side, he does
his singing.
Gigging.
And also, he's playing at this club, but then that Raul keeps trying to get owners of other clubs, bigger rooms, to look at him and then watch him perform.
Pit them against one another, one impresario against another, to try and jack up his singing fees.
Yeah. And, you know, we got to say, I mean, as this is happening, you know, we're being treated to one lame-ass hacky musical number like every 5 minutes.
It reminded me of something you'd see in the airport. Like, I know, when you'd fly into, like, Cuba or the Dominican Republic, like some hackneyed band that would just be playing in the terminal with these, like, cheesy shirts and a ukulele and, like, a horn, and it would just be so... just such a gaudy, like, pseudo spectacle. And here it seems like there's a mariachi band accompanying every tawdry, cheesy musical number. And they would sometimes they would, like, use the hats in the musical number, like, they would all have their hats turned low and then they'd all turn them up. It was just,
and half the songs he was singing was about some sort of matador,
or a town, and, or
Guadalajara,
El Torador,
stupid song about El Corridor, the matador, El Corridor. It's such a beautiful morning for a holiday, Acapulco. Look, here comes the sun, Acapulco.
Yeah, here's a cape, here's a cummerbund. Oh, God. Yeah,
you know, we get the duet between Raul and
Elvis on a bicycle as they're driving through town to the next gig. And this, we got to say by segue, none of this was filmed in Acapulco. No. So this was just with the exception of a few shots out the window, whether they managed to, like, pick up shots, I guess they'd be called.
Yeah.
This was all blue screened. And unbelievably cheesily so. And the stuff that they tried to reproduce Mexico in parts of California very ineffectively. Yeah. Beyond cheap, they used doubles of the King. Just really threadbare, just hastily assembled, slapdash crap. Mm-hmm. With crappy songs, cheese all around, a couple of perfunctory love interests.
Well, okay, so here's the plot in a nutshell. Here's Elvis Presley, or Mike Wingard, or whatever it is.
Mike Wingren. My Wingren.
An expat in Acapulco because he's running away from a tragedy in his past where he was a trapeze artist who was, I guess you would say, responsible for the death. It was a family.
Well, act. These things happen. I don't want to say he's responsible. No, but yeah, it was a high wire act.
Yeah.
He didn't grab his brother's arms, but I would believe it comes with the territory. I mean,
yeah, his brother plummeted to his death.
It's a circus act. Yeah. And, you know, these things happen.
All like Dick Grayson and
the Walenda brothers, the guy who went across Niagara Falls. Like, Grayson, these things happen.
But, you know, Dick Grayson's parents.
They die. Like, yeah.
So because of that, he's fleeing in Mexico, and now he's got this crippling fear of heights. And this whole movie is about, A, Elvis trying to overcome those crippling fear of heights. He had Moreno being the cliff diver. That's why he wants to be a lifeguard, because he wants to be able to go up and...
show up, Moreno.
And then he can go back to America, and now he triumphantly, what have you. And then there's this perfunctory love triangle, or quadrangle, whatever you want to call it, between Mike, Moreno, Dolores.
Dolores and
Dolores
Margarita.
Matador, who speaks about herself in the third person.
Yeah.
And Margarita, or Maggie, played by Ursula Andress, who complained about in this movie that they made her wear such, chaste bikinis. You know, this was pre or post Dr. No? This must have been...
Well, that must have been around the same time. I want to say 62, 63 was Dr. No. So, I mean, she was there for a reason. I mean, she's just eye candy, And Mike Wingren is juggling between these two voluptuous babes and trying to handle both of them. Dolores, cheesily as can be. And I didn't realize, because we associate Dolores with, like, an old lady name, but it's actually a Spanish name. It means sorrows. So it's interesting. This Dolores character was a bullfighter, and she wears this, like, you know, this black rimmed hat and tries to seduce him, and they dance together, and I don't know where that was going. And the Ursula Andress is some sort of European countess of some sort, whose father is a chef and wants to try and trick Mike into marrying his daughter so that he can get the equivalent of a green card, would have been at the time. So very bizarre, just the thrown together slapdash plot, an excuse to have these set pieces where Mike Wingren is wowing the Acapulco beach crowd, and that's about it.
Yeah, well, you say that's about it. So, but again, you know, it's not an Elvis movie without Elvis songs, and by and large, when it came to the songs that came out of Elvis movies, and I'm not talking about the early ones, I'm talking about Love, you know, I'm not talking about Jailhouse Rock or Love Me Tender. They were just cheesy, forgettable, awful songs. And do you happen to write down the name of some of these songs? There's Guadalajara.
Yeah, there's something about, there's something with the title, something Love in Acapulco, and then the, Guadalajara, and the Showstopper, which was the aforementioned Bossa Nova
Baby.
Bossa Nova. bossa nova, and it, where he cheesily like goes away from his two-step and jumps to the like pump organ or whatever it was, and he bangs out like incredibly fake notes on it, like a little riff, and you can tell his hands don't match, and his backup dancers sort of usurp him in dancing, and but while they're playing instruments, and it's just him
happening, and he's hitting the tom toms.
He's sitting between two, I guess, what, congo drums or whatever bongos, they were, bongos, and he's hitting them simultaneously.
It was just, I mean, it's a long way from Mr. Train.
Oh my God! Speaking of Jerry Lee Lewis and Johnny Cash and everybody,
the old Sun Studio days. I mean, to go from,
I've been to Sun Studios as well. To go from that period, this guy who just fashioned an entire art form based on mixing hillbilly music with black R&B and fashioning this and all this stuff.
Shook up to fucking Boston. Clam bake. We're gonna take those clams. Gonna put them in the oven. Gonna bake it up.
This is the crazy gringo at his worst. Yep. I guess is when another character calls him. It was depressing. The 90 minutes went by in a shot. Because on its own level, it was kind of enjoyable in a way, but it was surrounded by just an intense sadness and pathos, and like lugubrious is the fancy $2 word. It was sad to see a guy who just was on top of the world, and this wasn't even him getting into peanut butter and
banana sandwiches,
like sitting on the toilet and with popping pills in those cheesy like suits. He was still in good form. He looked amazing. He sounded amazing.
Well, that's the other thing.
It's just the music.
But he was starting to get puffier, and like, you know, he wasn't like this lean, mean rock and roll machine like he was in the 50s. He was starting to get, he looked good, but he was starting to get a little puffier in his movies. He wasn't, you know, it's funny. I think back when I was a kid, and I was very, very young, and my mother had all these like coffee table picture books of different artists, and not just artists, but like actors, what have you. It's an Elvis one. I'm flipping through it as like a 6-year-old, and I'm seeing these great black and white shots of Elvis in, you know, the early 50s, or mid-50s to the 60s, and I'm looking at Elvis going, awesome, cool, amazing, incredible. And then I see him getting his head shaved for the army. I'm like, oh, not so good, not so good. And then I see him when he comes back and he starts making these movies. I'm like, well, I mean, he did make Jailhouse Rock before he was in the army, but afterwards I'm like, oh my God. He's starting to look a little fatter. Things are not great. This is what's going on here. And then we get into the 70s. So he still looked good, but the thing is, he was already... like, just imagine being a kid in 56, or whatever year he was on Ed Sullivan, and losing your shit watching him playing, I believe it was, whatever, I don't know, what was the songs he played on Ed Sullivan? I don't remember. But losing your shit, and then watching Fun in Acapulco a scant 7 years later, and going, what the fuck?
It prompts the question, like, does he do himself, you know, one of these, like, a disservice, necessarily, by being taken from us so early? Because what would have happened in the 80s? Like, had he lived to survive when he's mopping his brow, like, the sweaty, just corpulence, it was depressing as all hell, in a way that... like, it's hard to reinvent yourself. You can count the people who have on one hand, and... we look at the last year where these luminaries were taken from us, your Prince or your Bowie, and these guys who were just incredible talents who were able to not let the ravages of time affect their career, but it makes you wonder where things would have gone.
The thing is, every time Elvis wanted to pull himself out, he was always pulled back in, and that was because of Colonel Tom Parker, who had Elvis under his thumb. And in, you know, this was the early 60s still. I mean, something was happening here, as they would say in that. It was something
happening
but
here.
This is not 67, the Summer of Love. That's when Double Trouble came out. I'm watching this movie. It takes place in London in the swinging 60s. You got these girls doing the whole mod shimmy and shit.
Yeah.
Elvis is singing songs like, I got double trouble. That's two times more than one.
Yeah.
He's not changing with the times.
Yeah.
But then in 68, he realized, you know, something happened, and he said, I gotta end this shit. And there was the long 68 comeback special, you know, again, iconic, black leather from head to toe, and there he was on stage all by himself, and he was singing
in the ghetto,
Elvis,
that kind
of
thing.
Old, and
well,
in the ghetto was more in the 70s, but like, he was, I don't know, I don't remember the chronology, but he was singing, everyone's like, Elvis is back, right? But then that didn't last long, because before you know it, he gets his residency in Vegas, then he becomes the white jumpsuit, scarf-wearing, mutton chop sideburn Elvis.
Yeah, the band gets bigger and bigger and bigger.
And he started, singing a lot more spiritual songs and gospel songs, and he's just popping pill after pill after pill, and, it was not long for this earth after that, and getting a lot fat. I don't know what would have happened if he would have, maybe somebody would have taken him out of the, away from the influences of not just Colonel Tom Parker, but all these hangers-on and yes-men that he had, the taking care of business crew, whatever. There's a lot of leeches and hangers-on and people that had no interest in Elvis Presley and nothing but a bank machine did. And he would buy Cadillacs for them, and he would buy all these things, and,
Speaking of what pissed me off at Graceland, you actually had to pay a separate fee to see his cars. Like, after you've already paid an exorbitant amount of money just to go see his, like, shag carpet ceilinged jungle room, which is just awful. Like, you always have these perceptions of people, and again, it speaks to his inability probably to transcend time. The fact that his aesthetic sensibilities were so off, and you look at this place, and it was ruinous to him in a way that if you tour David Bowie's place, any era, you can just imagine just thinking, this is the coolest thing ever. Like, or probably the same with Lou Reed. Like, he has such an aesthetic sense of himself and architecture and art. And I left Graceland feeling kind of dirty. And I felt like this is awful. This is a terrible, tacky, awful, in the way that Liberace was tacky and doesn't date well. It made me kind of sad. And it's, I don't know how long that's going to last. I think it's interesting because the phenomenon keeps going, and it doesn't do him any favors either. I'm thinking of the Elvis impersonation phenomenon. Like, north of here, there's the Collingwood Elvis Festival. It's a big worldwide festival where Elvis impersonators go to, southern Ontario and go and perform these hits. And it dilutes his...
It's funny that 95% of the Elvis impersonators, it's always a fat Elvis. It's always the biggest Elvis. You never see, a Sun Studios Elvis impersonator.
No.
Because he can't be emulated back then. He was sexuality in a bottle. He was rock and roll, personified.
Personified, yeah.
Yeah, so I don't know. I mean, it would have been interesting. Something could have happened. He could have maybe, I don't know, somebody, anybody, some...
Some Svengali could have taken him under his wing. Yeah. Maybe Rick Rubin could have taken him, and he could have made the American, like the Johnny Cash sessions.
That could have happened, but we'll never know because, he kicked it on the toilet. That's that. But it's, the thing with Elvis, though, these movies are depressing, but they don't take away from my esteem for Elvis Presley, his early years, when he first burst on the scene. And there's something about the 70s Elvis. Like, I recall, because I watch it often, and it's one of his last recorded performances. And he's singing at the piano, and he's singing Unchained Melody by the Righteous Brothers. And he is as fat as it can be. And he's singing at the piano with, two or three hangers on, and he's pounding this piano, and one of the hangers on is holding the microphone towards his mouth, and he's dripping sweat. I'm talking rivulets. And this other hanger on is wiping his brow throughout the entire performance. But as he's singing this song, the purity and the richness of the voice is coming out, that it just gives you goosebumps. And you're like, this song is blowing me away. This is like his last televised performance, and this is basically a dead man walking, and yet he's singing this wonderful song, Unchained Melody, and it just gives you goosebumps because that voice.
Oh yeah, that,
and the way he projects and the feeling and the emotion, it's unbelievable. So,
but I'm also thinking James Brown, who equally got fat, who equally had hangers on, wipe down his brow, and who's wearing these ridiculous, over the top, garish capes. Even he reinvented himself to take himself more into the drug era, more into the funk, deeper into the Parliament Funkadelic, even when he was playing like the George Foreman, the Muhammad Ali African concert. Like, he even had, he was still doing all the moves. He was still with it. He hadn't lost what made the Godfather of Soul so indelible, and he's still doing the splits. There was nothing pathetic about him until he really got into the coked out 80s. Even then, he was a quintessential performer, and it's just, yeah, there's just some kind of sadness. The untapped potential is what's sad. Because we would like him to be here now. We would like... Everyone needs a second chance. That's the great hope of America, right? Rebranding, rebuilding yourself from rebirth and death is what they're all about. And we never got a chance to see it with him.
Well, Elvis was... He was sheltered from the world by all of his
minions and hangers-on and doting courtiers and whoever else.
And he just didn't, youth culture started to baffle him. He could not get with, the flower power psychedelia, nor did I want him to. To me, I don't know, I couldn't picture Elvis, listen to the flower.
No, but he wasn't even in line with the Who, with the Can't Explain, the hard rock that came out in the mid-60s. He was done for.
And yet... when you had the punk era beginning, a lot of bands your Ramones and your Clash and whatnot, they cited Elvis as a major influence. And when they're talking about Elvis, they're talking about Elvis from 56 to 58,
the golden era.
Yeah. So Elvis Presley was sort of he was a bit of a punk icon.
Yeah.
And so I don't know. I mean, it's interesting. It's a very sad, tragic tale. But Elvis, really, when it comes to rock and roll musicians, there's very few that you can go to any corner of the globe and say the word that person's first name.
Yeah,
and they'll know who they are.
Yeah,
I can go to some village in Africa and be like, Elvis. Oh, they know Elvis.
Yeah.
You know? I don't know if I could say John Lennon or
Or Jim Morrison. Yeah. Doesn't work that way.
So the cultural reach and phenomenon of Elvis was enormous, and even though he suffered a very sad, precipitous fall from grace, never mind. I mean, when he was doing those Vegas concerts, the old blue-haired ladies in the audience were going into it. They were loving him. So I don't know, but anyway, listen. Getting back to the movie, let's talk about the movie itself, because we're talking about fun in Acapulco. Did you have fun in Acapulco? Did you enjoy the movie?
I did on a certain level. I enjoyed the repartee he had with the two girls that he was, whose attentions he was, vying. I enjoyed I guess she was European royalty or something. She had some weird nebulous duchess or countess title. Her father was some master chef, and I enjoyed, he was trying to impress Elvis with this weird dish, and I was trying to figure out what it was. It had to be served at 40 degrees.
Vichyssoise.
That's what it was?
It was vichyssoise.
Oh yeah. My God, have you had such a dish?
No, I have not.
But oh, wow. It's a master chef quality dish. And I thought, oh my God, I was like, what is this? But again, it speaks to, it's just from a bygone era, a Cobb salad, Acapulco from the 70s, the Rat Pack, my bad. Just, yeah, it dated when it wasn't dated. It already felt dated when it came out. It must have felt dated when it came out. Mm-hmm. We want to talk about what we've learned from this movie. Every hero has an antagonist, and Marino, aka Moreno, was the cliff diving Lothario. There's a great line between the two of them where he says, "You're you're the Tarzan of the South," and he says, "You, my friend, are the Casanova of the North." So they have this little battle, and at one time they do have a tête-à-tête that results in fist fights.
At one point they actually have a bit of a fisticuffs, and it was so telegraphed and cheesy. Yeah. They might as well put on Biff and Bam and the Batman TV series. It was.
Oh, and also the Berlitz course of Spanish, which you could learn Spanish from this movie. I mean, if you were going to replicate some dialogue, it would be, "Hey, señor, hasta luego," and just
hasta luego.
Every sort of cheesy line, and there's some vaudeville kind of cheesiness. Some of the mariachi band, they dedicate a song to some guys who like tequila, and then they say, "To us," and then it gets a big laugh. Just, oh my God, just pure cheese between the little kid Raul pitting one club owner against another, saying, "Hey, he said you were too cheap to pay for Mike Wingren." "Oh, he said that? No, you tell him I pay him, I'm doing a terrible accent, 2,000 pesos." And then he says, "Oh no, this guy's," and then he just boosts up the price of his gigs, and then he just wows the crowd all the time with his cheesy cummerbund and his just awful toreador outfit. Yeah. But again, the steps were there. The voice was there. He was trim. He was fit. He was just on the verge of going. You could see a transition. He might have been going to seed, but he looked dynamite. He sounded good. Songs did him no favors whatsoever. Just, again, cheesy airport mariachi, with the exception of Bossa Nova Baby. Just a banging song.
I want to hear your rendition of Bossa Nova yet again, because I...
Bossa Nova, Bossa Nova. Yeah, I'm doing the step, and then he'd go over to the piano, bang out a few keys. Oh, that was so cool. Like, that was really awesome. And the steps were done in coordination. The band was cooking. The crowd was into it. But again, one showstopper out of 11, not good odds there. Exactly. Not good stuff. Yep. No, what did you learn?
Oh, I not much. I mean, I think I talked a lot about what I've learned in terms of the career of Elvis, but I just talked about the whole fight scene with Biff and Bam and Boom, and yeah.
And I would have liked to hang out at El Torito's bar, like the little bull. Like, it would have been just great fun, just to be fending off Jailbait on the one hand, and Jailbait's father, and say, listen, I didn't have anything to do with that girl. And also, you know, trying to bed like a Mexican supermodel, and having Ursula Andress trying to make a play for your affections, even if they were impure. This is quite a life. Star rating.
Viva star rating! Viva! Two and a half stars.
2.5. Yeah. Elvis's pelvis, too dangerous for the masses and for the audience of this movie. 2-star for me. They didn't film it in Mexico. There was no sense of authenticity whatsoever from the songs all down, from on down. They were just he was maybe going through the motions. I mean, literally in some cases, other cases he looked. I mean, his moves were pretty fucking fantastic. Just again. Not the worst movie he's done. Would it be fair to say Double Trouble
that held that title? No, I mean, like I said, there's a lot more. I mean, the Climbake is probably the nadir, the oof, absolute worst.
Bottom of the barrel, huh?
But yeah, I mean, there's so many movies. Like I say, he made 29 movies, and oh god, it's
three to five are watchable.
Yeah, he made three movies in Hawaii alone. Yeah. it's just unbelievable.
Good God,
yeah.
Well, check out our website, www.reallyawfulmovies.com, for genre film reviews of all stripes, 2 to 3 times a week, for your reading pleasure and for your listening pleasure, which we derive none from this movie, but our podcast uploaded once a week, every Friday. The Really Awful Movies podcast, review us on iTunes, follow us on Twitter, awful_movies, and we love our musicals, generally. Mm-hmm. If you would like to send us a musical that we should cover, we love musicals. That would be great.
I got a few in mind for the future.
Oh, can't wait. Yeah. ReallyAwfulMovies@gmail.com. And thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
We'll talk to you soon.
Take care.